Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Allied forces now say that as they press their offense to push the Islamic State out of Syria, they have recaptured the country's largest oil field. The government lost the Al Omar field to other insurgents in 2013. Although heavy fighting does continue, Syrian Democratic Forces, with air support from the U.S.-led coalition, said Sunday it did recapture the airfield. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump issued a statement praising the SDF for recapturing the city of Raqqa from ISIS control. Mr. Trump said that the next move is to transition into a new phase in which we will support local security forces, de-escalate violence across Syria, and advance the conditions for lasting peace. In Niger, authorities say at least a dozen paramilitary police were killed in an attack similar to one that killed four U.S. Green Beret and four Nigerian troops on October 4th. Saturday's attack took place in the same area. Reports say the attackers were heavily armed with guns and rocket launchers. They arrived in five vehicles to launch their ambush. The attackers left when Nigerian military reinforcements showed up. At least 15 cadets have been killed, more wounded, after a suicide blast Saturday outside the Afghan Military Academy in Kabul. It came a day after an Islamic State suicide bomber stormed a crowded Shiite Muslim mosque, killing 50 worshippers. The Taliban insurgency said that it is claiming responsibility for the minibus bombing, saying the attack was part of its Mansouri insurgent operations underway against Afghan forces and their foreign backers. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula have been running high since North Korea accelerated its intercontinental missile test, and that also includes last month's hydrogen bomb test. As VOA's Yela DeFranceschi reports, experts believe that China will help de-escalate the situation.
Despite China's condemnation of Pyongyang's latest nuclear and missile activities, it hopes to avoid a collapse of the North Korean regime and the refugee influx across the border. But some experts argue that without China's help in solving the problem, South Korea and Japan are at risk.
What happens if South Korea asks the United States to return nuclear weapons to the peninsula, or they say, we need our own nuclear program? I mean, how could you deny that to them? Japan, which has already reinterpreted its constitution a bit to at least allow collective self-defense, real collective self-defense, what about perhaps offensive systems in the face of this threat? Vietnam, you know, where does this stop?
China has choices to make in the time ahead. I hope they choose to stand with the rest of the world and the United States and create a diplomatic outcome here.
The Trump administration is reviewing its China policy. It's expected to be complete before the president embarks on a trip to East Asia in November. Yela DeFranceschi, VOA News, Washington.
The Spanish Prime Minister, Mariano Rajoy, announced Saturday he would dismiss Catalonia's separatist government and call for new elections. VOA's Jamie Dittmer reporting.
The Senate in Madrid will vote on the Spanish government's direct rule plan, likely this week, marking the first time a region has seen its powers curbed. Less than half of the region's 7.5 million Catalans turned out to vote in the referendum, although 9 out of 10 who did backed independence.
If the pro-independence parties stay together, as they have claimed they will, there's probably a very low likelihood that the Spanish government has any enforcement capacity.
The confrontation between Catalonia and Madrid has clearly entered another critical phase. The stakes for both sides keep being raised. On Saturday, in response to Madrid, separatist leader Carles Puigdemont accused the Spanish government of seeking a coup d'etat in Barcelona. Jamie Dettmer for VOA News, Barcelona.
In a surprise Saturday morning tweet, President Donald Trump announced that he would also allow the release of thousands of long secret files relating to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 54 years ago. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Yes, they have the state machinery. Yes, they have the capital, but they don't have the people. Because at the end of the day, it is the people that are going to vote. As far as I'm concerned, they have all of those resources, but they don't have the people.
Supporters from the Sierra Leonean main opposition party celebrate the country's former military leader, Julius Maada Bio.
We are where we are. They have done their best in the very difficult circumstances. They say the ballots are here. I would believe it be the most wise thing to go ahead and vote personally, if you ask me.
The Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commissioner, IEBC, receives the first batch of ballot papers to be used for next week's presidential election rerun.
It is very clear that President Jacob Zuma found himself left with no option but to remove from the cabinet Dr. Blaise Nzimande so that he does as he pleases. This move by a disparate man is going to deepen crisis in South Africa.
And the South African Communist Party condemns President Jacob Zuma's latest cabinet reshuffle. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Supporters of former Sierra Leonean military leader Julius Maada Bio have organized a series of activities Sunday to celebrate his victory as the presidential candidate for the main opposition party. Maada Bio won the nomination to lead the Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP, to the presidential vote in next year's general election. But partisans from the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, insist the party won't form the next government. For the latest update, I reach parliamentarian Dixon Rogers from the main opposition SLPP in the capital, Freetown.
I'm very confident because in the first place, he ran in 2012. With the current president, who was so popular, yet still the result was rigged. And even when the results were rigged, he still pulled out 38%. Now that he's not the sitting president is not contesting any longer, we know that there is no candidate in the LPC who is as popular as Maada Bio. And because of the economic situation in the country, they have ruined the country. We believe a lot of people that we vote for Maada Bio in addition to the 38% he got in 2012.
Dr. Samura Kamara, the foreign minister who has been chosen to lead the ruling party, would have the government machinery and the government resources at his disposal, not forgetting the fact that this is an incumbent ruling party and everything will be done to support him to, you know, take over from Ernest Bai Koroma.
Thank you for the analysis. Well, let me take you back to the States, where you are calling from, right? The Democrats was in power. The former president campaigned for Hillary. But yet, I say, because the people wanted change, they changed the government. As far as I'm concerned, yes, they have the state machinery. Yes, they have the capital, but they don't have the people. Because at the end of the day, it is the people that are going to vote. As far as I'm concerned, they have all of those resources, but they don't have the people. In 2012, when SAP was in power, we had the state resources. We had the police to have the army on our side. Yet, still, the APC won the election. And I think ours is not going to be different. We are going to win this election based on the record of SAPB, based on the record of retired Brigadier Joseph Maada Bio, based on what it is has done in this country.
What does Maada Bio bring to the table?
One of the edges he has is the fact that this young man was in power in 1996. He promised this nation that he was going to conduct election in Hanover. the first head of military health state in Africa to have done that. That's one thing he's going to bring on the table: honesty, dedication, love for his people, loyalty to his country. The second thing he's going to bring on the table is the fact that he's running for a political party who has a record. So I believe in him, and that whatever he says, he will do.
There are some Sierra Leoneans who are saying that the opposition parties are divided and that will make way for the ruling APC party to win the election.
We know to remove the APC is not an easy task, and our president will be knows that. But let me bring you back to what I was saying when you did mention about the government having a state machinery, right? You've just gone through your elections in the states. 60% of the Republicans never favored or supported the current president, right? But today he's the president. As far as I'm concerned, our party is not divided. Before we went to the convention, every aspirant wants to be a flag bearer, had its own support, had its own group. But as far as I'm concerned, that has been fused into all of the LCPP campaign now. Because the Monday or Tuesday after the Sunday election, our president-to-be, retired Brigadier General Samada Bio, visited all those that he contested with. So as far as I'm concerned, we are together now and we remain together. But that doesn't mean that we'll fight alone. This is not going to be a one-party fight. All of us will come together. When we need the other smaller parties, we'll talk to them. We need to remove this dictatorship party in this country. We need to remove the party that doesn't care for our people. We need to remove this tyranny from this country. We need to remove a party that doesn't care about the feelings of his citizens.
Dixon Rogers is a parliamentarian from the main opposition Sierra Leonean People's Party, or SLPP. He spoke with me from Freetown. The Kenyan Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, says all is now set for Thursday's repeat presidential election. This after receiving the first batch of ballot papers to be used for the poll. But uncertainty remains after main opposition leader and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga announced he will not participate in the presidential poll rerun. The leader of the National Super Alliance, or NASA, says he would consider taking part in the election only if reforms his party demands are implemented ahead of the vote. For the latest development, I read Archbishop Martin Kivuva in the Kenyan coastal city, Mombasa.
We have people who want to go on with their life. If you don't have elections, you still have issues. If you have elections, you still have issues. So what we are encouraging ourselves to do is, because it's a divided matter, and we've got the new direction from the Supreme Court, we are saying, look, if Kenyans can allow each other, those who wish to go to court for elections, they are given the freedom to do so without being interfered with or being hindered to do so. And those who want to stay away, they do so. That would be also a bad decision, which way, at the end of the polling, we'll have to judge what way next. The judgment will come clear. Because right now, there is agitation both sides. What the law is demanding and being asking of people is just to be civil and people behave civilly, in the manner that country can go on.
There's so much uncertainty, yes, and Kenyans don't know what is going to happen next. You are an Archbishop. People have been talking to you. What have you been hearing about the way forward?
My look at these things, I'm saying, if we were civil enough, we would say, look, let everybody, at the moment, it's only 26, there's not much you can do. It's only a few days away. There's not much you can do. Already, some of the members of IEBC have set aside or resigned or went away. Nonetheless, the chairman, Chebukati, seems to say that the ballot present, that's a lot of money of the Kenyan people that will go away if nothing happens. And therefore, I would personally suggest, if you ask me, I would say, let's encourage those who wish to make a vote, make a vote. Without violence, let's promote that exercise to take place civilly. And those who feel strongly that, look, we are not ready for this reason, the other reason, then that's a verdict by the very two elections, one doing the other, one the other, that will be a verdict by the end of the 26th or 27th of the day.
Do Kenyans repose confidence in the IEBC's ability to organize credible elections, particularly when Wafula Chebukati, the IEBC chairman, says he can't guarantee credible elections?
Well, the thing is, we have how many days to the point? Very few days. And one of the things that is required for voting, of course, the IEBC is like the referee. The referee has made what they could do in the circumstances, because the circumstances have been very, very, pulling left and right and center. There have been issues among themselves. But nonetheless, we are where we are. They have done their best in the very difficult circumstances. They say the ballots are here. I would believe it would be the most wise thing to go ahead and vote personally, if you ask me.
That was Archbishop Martin Kivuva. He spoke with me from Mombasa. The South African Communist Party, or SACP, has condemned the recent cabinet reshuffle, which saw the removal of cabinet member Blade Nzimande, the leader of the Communist Party. President Jacob Zuma removed Nzimande from his position as Minister of Higher Education and Training in a reshuffle last week. His removal came after Nzimande criticized President Zuma and called on him to step down. Nzimande also described his removal as a deliberate move by the president to credit others for possible no-fee hikes. For more reaction, I reach Alex Mashelu, spokesman for the South African Communist Party.
It is very clear that President Jacob Zuma was unhappy with Dr. Blade Nzimande leading criticism against state capture and corruption and other forms of wrongdoing in government. It is very clear that President Jacob Zuma did not tolerate that, and he found himself left with no option but to remove from the cabinet Dr. Blade Nzimande so that he does as he pleases. This move by a disparate man, which in our view it is actually, is going to deepen crisis in South Africa. There is a meeting of senior alliance leaders we call the Alliance Political Council on Thursday. That meeting will be the first meeting to take place since the SACP took a decision that President Jacob Zuma must resign. At that meeting, that decision will be furthered, and we are looking forward to other alliance partners feathering the same decision to the extent they have taken it.
Supporters of President Zuma are saying that it is not fair for the SACP to threaten that the alliance could be strained because of the cabinet reshuffle undertaken by President Zuma, and that every cabinet member serve at his pleasure. How do you respond to that?
Zuma is serving under the pleasure of the African National Congress in alliance with the South African Communist Party, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the South African National Civics Organization. South Africa does not have, unlike the United States, a presidential system. It is a multi-party democracy where political parties are elected to parliament on the basis of proportional representation. This is recognized in our constitution. When you are elected to such position, it is only fair that you consult with the organization on whose behalf you are acting in government. It is totally unfair for any person to think that we have an alliance that must function or that must be useless. Our alliance is not useless. It is an alliance that must be consulted. It is not an alliance where Zuma will sit somewhere with his friends or whoever he discusses matters with, take decisions without consultation, And when we raise this matter, we are told that is unfair. That is actually rubbish. We are not going to tolerate this. Zuma has brought the alliance almost to the brink of collapse, and we cannot leave this matter lying down.
There are suggestions that Madam Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, his ex-wife, could possibly lead the ANC once Jacob Zuma, the president, is gone. Will the SACP support such a move or support the candidacy of Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma if the ANC chooses her?
We did not discuss the individual candidates of the ANC. We discussed what we believe are broad fundamental principles that must be taken into account in electing leaders. We don't want leaders who are corruptible, leaders who are backed by corrupt and captured people. We need leaders who will be able to unify the ANC, the alliance, and the support base of the African National Congress. We need leaders who will act against state capture and corruption without fear, favor, or prejudice.
So what's next for the SACP in this challenge that it faces? Because I understand most of the SACP members are displeased with what is going on in government.
Almost all SACP members are not happy. So on Friday, there will be a meeting of the Central Committee of the SACP to discuss the way forward. We will take things from there. That meeting will start on Friday and end on Sunday.
Alex Mashelo is the spokesman for the South African Communist Party. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. Boko Haram's renewed campaign of suicide bombings in far north Cameroon has bred suspicion that remains even as attacks have died down. Local communities are currently blocking 400 former Boko Haram hostages from returning home. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the border town of Mozogo, where the former hostages are stranded.
Hundreds of former Boko Haram hostages and fighters are lining up to be served food at Mozogo on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. They look tired and hungry. Among them is 45-year-old Asta Hamina, brought into the camp a week ago by the Cameroon military. She says she was found around Sambisa Forest, a former stronghold of the insurgents.
I'm half of
She says when she remembers the torture she went through in the Sambisa forest, she is frightened and prays that such a thing should never happen again. She says her wish is to return home and start her life all over again. But her dream of returning home may not be achieved soon. Some of the hostages have confessed that after they were taken hostage by Boko Haram fighters during attacks on their villages and taken to Nigeria, they were forced to join the jihadist group as fighters and their children were used as suicide bombers. Haruna Abba, a community leader at Mozogo, says they are not ready to accept the former hostages in their villages for fear of being infiltrated once again by the terrorists. He says some of them may be spies or been brainwashed with Boko Haram ideology.
Ce que nous demandons maintenant à l'État, il faut que la population soit sécurisée. Ce n'est que ça.
He says they first of all want the government of Cameroon to assure them of their security and safety. He says their resources are stretched and the economic needs of villagers who braved attacks and stayed home will increase if they allow the former hostages to return. He says villagers already lack water to drink and it will be terrible if they share the little they have. Some of the former hostages said they spent 2 years with Boko Haram and decided to flee and hand over themselves to the military or local self-defense groups. Others said they had fought for Boko Haram but chose to lay down their arms because they realized they were misled. Mozogo is one of the Cameroon towns that have suffered severe Boko Haram atrocities, with schools, markets, churches and mosques burned by members of the group. Mijiyawa Bakari, governor of Cameroon's far north region, is pleading with communities to receive the former hostages and assuring them that the government will protect them.
Beaucoup ont pu traverser. Tous disent avoir rompu avec la secte. Ils sont prêts à revenir.
He says many of the former hostages have assured him that they do not have anything to do with the terrorist group and are ready to contribute to building their country. He says among the returnees in the camp are 120 girls, 125 boys, and many children of school age, and they have been asking the UNHCR to consider either creating an orphanage or opening a school in the camp should the returnees stay be extended. He says Cameroon's president has asked for a more secure site to be provided to the returnees for the meantime. Soldiers from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, part of the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, have rolled back Boko Haram gains since last year, but the insurgency remains a potential threat. The conflict that began in northeast Nigeria 8 years ago has left at least 25,000 people dead and led more than 2.6 million others to flee their homes. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Mozogo, Northern Cameroon.
At China's Communist Party Congress last week, a meeting of the country's autocratic government held every 5 years, President Xi Jinping said the country would be a contributor to global development. Key to that is the so-called One Belt, One Road initiative, which seeks to rekindle ancient Silk Road trade routes linking China with Europe and Africa. Billions of dollars have been plowed into infrastructure projects along the route, but as individual reports for VOA, there are calls for China to focus on development goals such as alleviating poverty.
Running 1,300 kilometers over the world's highest mountain pass, the so-called Friendship or Karakoram Highway is evidence of China's willingness to spend big. Costing tens of billions of dollars, the road links Western China with Pakistan, part of Beijing's One Belt, One Road initiative, a central tenet of President Xi's leadership, says Professor Steve Tsang of London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
The government is committed to do whatever it can to make sure that it is successful. So a lot more money and resources will be put into it to support that.
But figures show since the Karakoram Highway was built, Pakistani exports to China have actually fallen, while imports have increased, raising concern China's new Silk Road could become a one-way street. Stephen Gelb of the Overseas Development Institute says Beijing should focus its investments on global development goals.
At the moment, there's a lot of focus on infrastructure and particularly transport, pipelines, that sort of thing, which don't directly address poverty. And in fact, there's been in some cases some controversy about the social and environmental impacts. But I think the aim should be to address development, including poverty and related issues.
Think about it. Gliding above the choking road traffic of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, the Chinese-funded tramway system opened last year at a cost of $500 million. Beijing says investments like this will boost African economies, thereby alleviating poverty. Gelb says it is also part of China's plan to become a dominant force on the global stage.
That was affirmed in Xi Jinping's speech. China is very much about these days rules-based global governance, multilateralism, globalization.
Visiting India this week, US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson accused China of not always playing by those rules.
China, while rising alongside India, has done so less responsibly, at times undermining the international rules-based order.
Recipient countries have welcomed Chinese investment, which sometimes comes with fewer conditions than Western aid, such as demands for democratic reform. But Professor Steve Tsang warns there could be a sting in the tail.
The real issue will come when some of those countries, particularly in Central Asia, have to pay back some of the loans that were accrued in the Belt and Road Initiative. And most of those countries will have problems paying back those loans.
For now, Chinese investment continues to expand. Development campaigners say Beijing's focus should be not only on ports and pipelines, but on tackling poverty. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I woke up early this morning and I said a little prayer to my God. I said, oh Lord, help me. I need to make some money today. It will be a long, long day. Just like any that I ever heard. It will be a hot, hot day, and the rain might come down on me. Oh Lord, I just want a little to get me over. Just a tiny, weeny little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel alive.
Free.
me over. Just a tiny, weeny little for me to party. I just want a little to make me feel,
I'm
ujue nakowaza usiku na mchana kulira kwa gala nyo wambi nazira kwa nani uma sana.
Mademba, Bugulwo, Lemmy. Mademba, 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 Bugulwo, Lemmy. Tigunekta, hi, Momo, Dougal, Mimi. Sama, Helbi, DJ, yeah. Mama jungle fetch you by Kau Kaula, Hegunetta, Mama jungle fetch you by Yemen. Fima neko kumba il majitan, Tema fatisamai chosan, Ama fatisamai adan, yeah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Woman's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, the deployment of United States military forces in Africa became an acrimonious discourse. The reason is that on the 4th of October, in the midst of the hurricane season in the United States, it was reported that 4 United States military soldiers were ambushed and killed in Niger. 3 of the soldiers were immediately removed, but the 4th took 48 hours before his body was retrieved by natives and then evacuated. These four soldiers happened to be that of an African-American. Now, the press were not aware, nor Congress, of the mission of the soldiers. And after 12 days, without any announcement by the White House, the press began to pose serious questions. The initial response of the White House was to deflect the issue by dealing with whether or not the president or previous presidents called grieving parents after they have lost their dear ones. But still, the Congress and the media wanted to know, what is the scale of United States deployment of military forces in Africa? Yes, it was known that United States has a military base in Djibouti alongside that of France and China. It was also known that the United States has sent military officers to assist Nigeria in the fight against Boko Haram. Similarly, that the United States has been attacking Al-Shabaab forces in Somalia and flying drones in and around the region. But no one knew precisely what the mission in Niger was. At the present time, the Pentagon and the FBI are conducting an investigation to determine the circumstances in which the soldiers were ambushed and died, and also to state precisely the mission of the United States in Niger. But now news are coming out that the U.S. may have about 800 troops in Niger, where you may recall there is a large uranium mine, and that in the Sahel region as a whole, the U.S. might have now about 1,500 troops. So this is where Africans themselves may need to be aware of what the African plans are on the African continent. In this connection, one must bear in mind that during the administration of President Bush, many African states were concerned about reports that the United States African Command might be established on the African soil. And President Bush, in a visit to Accra, Ghana, eased this concern when he pledged that the United States African Command would not be established on the African soil. Now, reports are coming that a large drone base is being built in Chad. And with all the involvement in Niger, Africans should begin to take notice. And the strange irony of what is now going on in debate in the United States and Africa is that in 2016, the presidential debate between Democrats and Republicans, or between Hillary Clinton and Trump, fashion around the theme Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. And that was because of the death of the U.S. ambassador to Libya in Benghazi, and the Obama administration was held responsible for that. Now the Republicans have their own problem with Niger. As this debate goes on, Africans should themselves follow it so we can see where Africa is going to be placed. What is now clear that is in this global fight against international terrorism, the major theater may become Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. We'll be right back. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, producer Douglas Impuga and our engineer for today, Bill Barber, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no one drinks medicine on behalf of a sick person. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most efficient ways to promote peace and jumpstart flagging economies is to empower girls and invest in their education. Today, girls' lack of access to basic education is compounded when it comes to the use of digital technology, leaving them far behind boys. And because the world is ever more digital, those who lack basic internet skills will find it increasingly more difficult to participate in the formal economy, to obtain a quality education, to access healthcare, information, and psychosocial support. Support to have their voices heard. Since 2013, the global gender gap in male and female access to the internet has actually increased from 11% to 12%. Worse yet, women and girls living in the poorest countries are 31% less likely than men and boys to have access to the internet. In developing countries, some 200 million fewer women than men own a mobile phone, the most common means of internet access there. This digital divide is increasing, and should it continue at the present pace, it is projected that over 75% of women and girls will lack internet access and digital skills. There are many causes for the digital gender gap. They include girls' exclusion from basic education writ large, from specific technology education and design, high costs of both devices and internet access, scarcity of content relevant for women and girls, and sociocultural biases and discrimination, such as barriers to women speaking freely and privately, both online and offline. Indeed, one of the most insidious reasons why girls may be discouraged from learning how to access and use digital technology is also a groundless one, that girls are simply not adept at using technology. The United Nations has affirmed that human rights online are human rights offline. These stereotypes reinforce harmful norms that keep women and girls from enjoying their human rights. The gender digital divide is a major roadblock to women's economic empowerment and participation in the economy. Without a major escalation of policy effort and investment, most of the benefits of technological change will be enjoyed only by men, exacerbating gender inequality. In the words of USAID Senior Gender Coordinator Michelle Beckering, a girl's future should be defined not by her sex, but by her commitment to hard work and ability to access the resources she needs to succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.